This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 24th of March 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 128th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Well, what do we have here? First of all, we welcome government-worrying filmmaker Errol Morris. He's talking about his new film, The Unknown Known, all about Donald Rumsfeld.
Often I think Rumsfeld uses language to trick, deceive, and manipulate himself so that he never, ever, under any circumstances, has to face reality.
Then we get the lowdown on the high points of this year's recently wrapped South by Southwest Festival in Texas from British music plugger Crispin Parry.
I'd say one of the things that's going to come back, one of the trends that I spotted was watch for the saxophone. There were bands with saxophones, the saxophone's coming out of everyone's ears.
And our wondering about what it would be like to visit this year's Marrakesh Biennale was answered. Kimberly Bradley reports.
Then we have artists from Algeria, from Mexico, from India, from Berlin. And we really wanted to create this dialogue between local, regional and international.
Plus, I'll be taking a walk around the current Richard Hamilton exhibition at London's Tate Modern and sharing some tracks from Jessica Hoop's new album, Undress. What more could you need over the next 53 minutes than this? Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Music time first, folks, and we're taking tracks from Undress, the new album from Jessica Hoop. The Californian singer-songwriter's reimagined and recut tracks from some of her previous albums, stripping them of some of their now seemingly extraneous instrumentation, hence the title Undressed. The album involves a few notable collaborators, Sam Beam from Iron and Wine, Willie Mason and Erica Winnerstrom, amongst them. But the first track we'll hear is sung with Elbow's Guy Garvey. This is Murder of Birds.
And I think I'm alone in desire for grace. For you unleash your mood and I'm no longer safe. I say I hate you and I love you the most. Love you the most. Love you the most.
That was Murder of Birds from Jessica Hoop featuring Guy Garvey. And we'll have more songs from that new album, Undress, a little later in the show. Now we turn to a titan of the documentary format. Errol Morris won an Oscar for his 2003 film, The Fog of War, and he returns to familiar territory for The Unknown Known, about the life and career of one of recent history's most infamous characters, former US Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Like a political zealot, Rumsfeld was there during Vietnam, served for Nixon around the time of Watergate, was a key player in the sort of climbing down of the chilly hostilities of the Cold War, and served in George W. Bush's administration that tried and failed to snuff out Al-Qaeda, so instead waged war on Iraq. Unlike Zelig, he wasn't just there, but he was instrumental. Errol Morris's taut, fascinating, and at times very funny film spends almost 2 hours trying to see behind Rumsfeld's outward show of avuncular hair-splitting to the man and the motivations beneath. The film, like Rumsfeld, is an amazing piece of work, if you get my drift. Here is Errol Morris.
Unknown knowns. That is to say, things that you think you know, that it turns out you did not.
The unknown known is both things that you know that you didn't think you know and things that you think you know that you don't know. Take your pick. It's that way across the board. These endless slogans, epithets, maxims, rules. I call it Donald Rumsfeld's Chinese fortune cookie philosophy.
And there does seem to be that a lot of that in there. Did you get the sense that there's a moment in the film where he says that he wasn't trying to, in inverted commas, do history with all these various tens of thousands of memoranda that he had dictated? Did you get a sense that he was trying to do history? Because he speaks in what he thinks, I guess, is an epigrammatical way, doesn't he, for example?
It really depends on what you mean. Sorry to sound like Donald Rumsfeld here. What you mean by do history.
Yeah.
I would think it's a version of obliterating history. If you write enough memos, if you create a paper tsunami, then somehow the world just vanishes.
Yeah. And is that the thing? Is it about prevarication, all these decades of what are called and what he calls snowflakes or these paper memoranda?
I would say beyond. Is that a concept, beyond prevarication?
I don't know, but it sounds like a sequel.
It does, doesn't it? Prevarication suggests that he's trying to hide something and he's lying about it. He is lying unendingly, but I don't think he's hiding anything. I think he's just in a kind of bubble universe of his own devising. It's one of the most disturbing interviews I've ever done.
July 27th, 2001. Sanctions are being limited in a way that cannot weaken Saddam Hussein. We can publicly acknowledge that the sanctions don't work over extended periods and stop the pretense of having a policy that is keeping Saddam in the box, when we know he's crawled a good distance out of the box. Within a few years, the U.S. will undoubtedly have to confront a Saddam armed with nuclear weapons.
And were there conditions on what you got to ask?
No. I had complete editorial control. I explained to him very early on, if I allowed him to control what was in the movie, no one would take it seriously. It was just something that was non-negotiable. But I did show him the movie as I was editing it. I invited him to make comments, to criticize it. And so I got many of my own memos from Donald Rumsfeld with a list of criticisms of what he liked and what he didn't like, mostly what he didn't like.
What didn't he like? Because there are some moments in the film which are very powerful moments where you let him finish his answer and you keep the camera rolling. Is this a technique simply to make sure that you get the answer in the bag, on the tape, as it were? Or is this a clever way of interviewing a subject to make sure that there's a way of kind of almost giving them enough rope to hang themselves slightly by putting these lovely pauses in?
The pauses are very important. Often things that are not said directly, but expressed through gesture. In this case, the smile, the infernal smile, the grin that keeps popping up again and again in the film, as if he can't control it. Often it's inappropriate. I often thought of the Cheshire Cat, Alice in Wonderland. Alice says, "I've often seen a cat without a grin, but I've never seen a grin without a cat." Well, there you go. If you're interested in a grin without a cat, please go see my film.
That sounds like it needs to be a quote on the poster. Some, you know, I guess you can we can use your own quote on the poster.
I would think so, yes.
And it does seem like that this is a technique that your subject, Donald Rumsfeld, used in questions at the White House. I mean, this was his way of dealing with the press. Is it sort of strange to have it meted out to you personally in a room with a camera rolling?
Is this really turning the tables on him? I never really quite thought of it that way. Perhaps yes. The White House press conferences were theatrical performances. There he is, presiding over a room of reporters, dodging questions, giving often gobbledygook answers. What's so amazing to me is he got away with it for so long. He's a salesman for the policies of the Bush administration. And like any salesman, perhaps you do a better job if you actually believe your own bullshit. What scared me about Rumsfeld ultimately is I think he does believe his own bullshit. I think he's actually totally convinced these were wonderful policies. Iraq is better off. It really doesn't matter. They couldn't find those pesky WMDs. Made sense to invade anyway. The invasion was fine. People are just naysayers. How dare they? We did a wonderful job. It's almost as if he's waiting for applause.
And that's when that smile comes in at the end of so many of his tortured analogies and or tortuous analogies. And
yes, it's the look of supreme self-satisfaction. The man just utterly in love with himself.
Why the obsession with Iraq and Saddam?
Well, you love that word, obsession. I can see the glow in your face when you say it.
Well, I'm an obsessive person.
Are you? I'm not. I'm cool. I'm measured.
I wanted to ask you, Errol, about the filmmaking process as well as the subject. It's a very dense film, the way that you obviously are obsessed with his constant need to define words and question the definition of words. The lovely way of popping these definitions up, and as Rumsfeld speaks on the screen, and all the rest of it, and this lovely analogy of the snowflakes, of these memoranda that float through, particularly that element when he's talking about the swamp, the state of the Middle East, I guess, in the late 1970s and early 1980s. Do you have in your head an idea of how that film was going to look, considering it is so much based on words and the definition of words and the sort of tortured way that words can be skewed?
I knew it was going to be history from the inside out, turn everything inside out, upside down, however you want to describe it. I wanted to make a movie about how Donald Rumsfeld sees himself using these memos, which he calls snowflakes, because he produced tens of thousands of them. These were released to me. They have never been made public before. He gives us dramatic readings of his own snowflakes in the movie.
I found that surprising. That was interesting as well.
He loved it. And through the snowflakes and through the oral history, we get a picture of how he wants us to see him, how he sees himself. If you like, that nightmare universe to me that he inhabits. It's been described often to me as Orwellian. George Orwell's name comes up again and again and again because of this obsession with language. But in Orwell, language is used to control people. A politician will use words in order to trick and deceive, to manipulate. Often, I think Rumsfeld uses language to trick, deceive, and manipulate himself so that he never, ever, under any circumstances, has to face reality.
When Rumsfeld is selling himself, selling his old policies again to you as an interviewer, what persona do you take on? What face do you make when you're sitting opposite him using your interrotron, so-called, way of shooting your subjects? He's looking right down the camera and he's selling me as a viewer and he's selling you as a filmmaker something. What are you doing?
I try to be engaged. I try to listen attentively. I try to think about what is being said. I've been interviewed many, many, many times myself, so I know what it's like. The shoe has been on the other foot. What you want in an interviewer is someone who actually is listening to you, is responding to what you say, is intellectually engaged by the conversation. It's really no different. I often have to like the people that I'm talking to, or I can't do the interview at all. This has been a very strange experience because I enjoyed talking to Donald Rumsfeld. He can be extraordinarily charming. He's a great interview subject in many, many ways. You can't imagine a person more animated, more expressive, more dramatic in how he speaks. And yet the end of it just left me with a feeling of horror. No real explanation of why we went to war. No satisfactory explanation of anything. Just self-righteousness, self-satisfaction. There's a dream, you know, maybe this is connected with democracy, I think it is, that the people running our government really have some moral compass, some moral sense. There's a reason for what they do. I couldn't find the reason here. Call it my failure or his failure. But to me, it's a movie about the absence of something that should be present. I was invited to sit in on a series of interviews. The first day I met him, he brought me into his conference room and he was interviewed by reporters from Fort Bliss. So the reporters asking the same questions over and over and over again. Did you feel you had enough preparation for the war? Did you feel there were enough troops? Did you plan carefully enough for the aftermath? I thought, I'm not going to ask those questions. I'm going to do something different. And often the most surprising answers came out of nowhere. I asked him about the infamous torture memos, the memos that essentially authorized torture, one of the blackest stains in American history, in my view. And he said, never read them. You hear my voice in the film saying, really?
Yeah.
Really? As if.
With pride. With pride.
Yes, with pride. Because I was amazed. Amazed not because I thought he was lying to me. Amazed because I thought he was telling me the truth.
Stuff happens. And free people are free to make mistakes. And commit crimes and do bad things. They're also free to live their lives and do wonderful things.
And you have to pick and choose. Well, to the extent you pick and choose and you're wrong, the penalty can be enormous.
That was Errol Morris, whose new film, The Unknown Known, is in cinemas next week. You're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where next we move from foreign diplomacy to a bit of cultural diplomacy at this year's South by Southwest.
Monaco has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monaco shop.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where we're now going to help Crispin Parry, founder of the UK music promoting organisation British Underground, make sense of this year's recently wrapped South by Southwest Festival in Texas. Fresh back from Austin with a suitcase full of promo CDs, memory sticks, flyers, fanzines and presumably a few odd phone numbers, Crispin's going to help us define the key bands, themes, genres and sponsors of this year's intense jamboree of music, networking and drinking beer from noon in Austin. Welcome back to the Culture Show, Crispin Parry.
One of the things about South by Southwest, I mean, the event has been going for over 25 years, maybe about 28 years, and it was originally started as a sort of showcase for local bands. And so of course it's going to change. And as those kind of showcases, these conventions started to grow, and I think the way that South by Southwest worked is that the American industry came down to see those bands, and then the American bands came down because the industry was there. And then maybe about a dozen years ago, the international industry started coming down. So that was your White Stripes, your Strokes time. I mean, I was very much involved in the building the presence of the UK over there with putting on showcases and parties and things. So You want it to change. And I think sort of veterans like myself, if you feel you want it to be back like it was around the year 2000, then I think you've got the event wrong. It is very, very exciting now. It is absolutely huge.
And we were talking before we switched on the microphones about all the different kind of things that we saw there. And I'll list them. There was Casa Brazil, there was German House, Hackney House, there was a big K-pop delegation there. Yep. from South Korea. How do these people set themselves up? Are they all in one venue? Are they spread across the city? How does a buzz start sort of building up about these particular sort of national pavilions, as it were?
There's a whole new area called Rainy Street, which is an area that was all going to be knocked down at one point, but it was sort of taken over by pop-up bars. So these beautiful houses with a stoop at the front and a pop-up venue at the back have set themselves up in this area. And one of the main things that's there, I mean, for the first time, there was a Casa Brazil, which, bear in mind, there's a huge interactive festival that happens first, and then there's a parallel film festival that goes on. So Casa Brazil set up really to promote its interactive technologies with music added on. Three or four houses down was the German House. This was very interesting because that had been there for a little while, and what they were hosting there, it seemed to be a mixture of international acts and German acts. They had a big sort of hamburger sort of day where they gave everyone hamburgers to promote local festivals and things. Mm-hmm. And down that area, anyway, there's some great bars like the Black Heart where some very, very good shows happen. So these institutions and these countries are there really just to say, we are here, we have... there's a lot of networking will go on there, a lot of private networking and business-to-business stuff will go on there. And then the music is sort of added on to that to add a little bit of flavour into the culture to it.
And so these bands, we mentioned the South Koreans, these perhaps have an American influence, they're media trained. Is this something, or do they feel a bit wet around the ears?
Media trained, I doubt whether that would be the main concern. I think they are at a level where they've got enough heat behind them in their own country, and maybe they've already got some pitchfork or they've got some interest from America or some other Western nation that says you should now go and meet those people who are interested in you. It's that sort of level, really. I mean, I think they're not sort of being nurtured by the government or the cultural institutions. Mm. They're just being recognised by them.
T for Texas, a T for Tennessee. Oh Lord, a T for Texas, a T for Tennessee.
Let us go back to the future. One of the other things you wanted to talk about was roots, was American roots music.
Well, the whole foundations of South by, or Austin, I guess, where South by Southwest is held, is it has this most extraordinary history of Americana music, of alternative country music. And if you, you know, sort of pull back the layers a little bit, you can find all of that. And of course, all of the heads of state from that industry and all of those musicians are heading to South By to continue those conversations that have been going on since the dawn of South By. So I did go and have a look to see what was happening in that area. Interesting bands. I mean, all of the bands that you would expect to see there, there are touring bands like Felice Brothers and people like Robert Ellis are going down there. Even sort of veterans like Hal Gelb are in the mix, sort of just saying, well, these are my people. And they're playing maybe a little bit out of town. There's a great bar called Thread Gills, which hosts the New West Party. It hosts Americana parties. It hosts the Folk Alliance party. So all of the daytime parties, which is a big part of how this whole thing fits together, they've got their own places, their own real estate within this great mashup of all of this other stuff.
And the UK did well this year. There are a couple of UK bands or UK acts that you wanted to name check, Crispin. Talk us through these.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I'm very aware of when I'm there is what is the buzz? What are people talking about in terms of UK artists? And actually, just prior to going this year, I thought, well, actually, there's going to be an interesting year. There's some really good bands heading out there. They're doing different things. They're not all kind of alt rock. I mean, it's a big alt rock place, but there's all sorts of other stuff there. I mean, there's a huge growing sort of hip hop community there. There's the Americana community. There's something for everyone at the event. But bands like Jungle added a great funky element. There's an artist called Sophie who confounded but also excited an awful lot of people. We had Melt Yourself Down. I mean, I'd say one of the things that's going to come back, one of the trends that I spotted was watch for the saxophone. That's going to be an instrument.
Oh, well, I thought this when I heard Bowie's new album last year. I was like, this sounds so good.
There were buskers with saxophones. There were bands with saxophones. Saxophones coming out of everyone's ears.
So, Lisa from The Simpsons will get rehired. It'll be fine. And just finally, to get an idea of how you, you know, as a pro and as an old hand at going to South by Southwest, how you pace the day and how many bars into a band you decide whether you're going to stay or go.
I like to hear something in the distance and go, what is that sound? What is that? I mean, South By is a good one for that. So that sort of chance encounter for me is very important at South By. There are people with extraordinary charticles and papers and spreadsheets that they're there and they've got everything mapped out. I will tend to have three or four things across a day that I want to go and see. Again, if I've made the effort to put them in my sort of notes, then I'll probably stay there for the whole of the set. I'd like to see what it is that they're doing. So one of my favourites this year, Fat White Family, I went to see at least three of their shows. The first one I saw was at 12 noon on the Friday. Now, this is a band that really delivers quite a heavy live performance. And honestly, it was heavier and more menacing at 12 lunchtime when they clearly hadn't had any lunch. So and I stayed all the way through that and then followed that band around because I just wanted to find out more about what that was about.
That was Crispin Parry, head of British Underground, on this year's Defining Moments at South by Southwest. I am Robert Bounds, and this is The Culture Show on Monocle 24. Still to come in part two, we'll explore a little more of Jessica Hoop's new stripped-back album, Undress, take a tour around the new Richard Hamilton show at Tate Modern, and cruise the souks and shows at this year's Marrakesh Biennale. Three good reasons to keep on listening to This Culture Show with me, Robert Bound. Time for another track from this week's album, Undress, by Jessica Hoop. Here she is collaborating with Erica Venestrom on a track with a great folky feel called Tulips. That was Tulips by Jessica Hoop, singing there with Enika Venestrom, and that is from the new album Undress. You're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bounds. And now we're going all the way to South London to get a tour of the current big show at Tate Modern. I say big show, not in a showbiz way, but because the retrospective of British pop art pioneer and all-round post-war artistic trailblazer Richard Hamilton is such a rich and sprawling thing. Sure, it opened a few weeks ago, but we wanted to get a walkabout with the show's curator, Mark Godfrey, with whom Hamilton collaborated on the planning of the exhibition until his death in 2011 at the age of 89. Hamilton was a polymath of styles, interests and materials who did everything first. Pop, installations and projections, collages steeped in contemporary context, the fetishism of consumer products, inventing the artist as brand. On a bright morning at Tate Modern, Mark Godfrey gave me his tour.
We're now in a room which is called the Fun House. It's Hamilton's contribution to an exhibition that took place in 1956 at the Whitechapel Art Gallery, which was called This Is Tomorrow. And Hamilton worked with two other people, John Volker and John McHale, to make what he called the Fun House. It was an environment that you entered that was like a kind of hall of mirrors in a fairground. It had things that you could smell. There was strawberry scents, things that you could hear. There is a jukebox playing music from the 50s. Lots of things to see, especially collaged images from magazines that he'd got hold of from the States, a cutout of Marilyn Monroe, and a billboard of posters from 1950s movies. And, you know, this is a moment when artists like Hamilton are looking from Britain, a very austere place, still with rationing and so on, and they're looking at American culture and being kind of amazed by what's going on in America at this time.
It still is a kind of disorientating experience now. It must have made such a splash at the Whitechapel in the 50s.
Yeah, I think of all the different pavilions, because this was one of 12 different contributions to that show, This Is Tomorrow. This is probably the one which really did feel like tomorrow. So the way you could feel the ground actually change beneath your feet. There's what, as you walk through, there's a bit which is squishy, a bit which is graty, and a bit which is smooth. There was stuff to feel, smell. You could speak into a microphone and so on. And I think also you're blasted with all these images from Hollywood, from adverts, from of new things that you could buy and weird things that you could see, spinning discs with black and white patterns. So it would have felt dizzying then, particularly.
Here we are, we're in room 9 now. This is Design Architecture Products, 1964 to 1979. There's a lot of symbols in here, a lot of signs. We've got these abstracts. They look like a sort of occluded photographs with mirrors. Or well, they could be anything. They look like a microwave oven. Maybe it's a toaster.
Yeah, so Hamilton, as well as being interested in American culture, was really fascinated by new design coming out of West Germany, and particularly the Braun Company. You know, it's been said that Braun held a kind of a place in Hamilton's heart as important as Mont Saint-Victoire in Cézanne's heart. Actually, that was Hamilton who said it. And Hamilton was really interested in Braun products. He made works which are using Braun catalogues. He at one point used a Braun electric toothbrush, but in the work called Toaster, he takes a Braun toaster and he makes a relief based on this. He also makes this work so that there's a relief of a toaster that's set against a very blurry background. And that means that you see a blur, but you also see a very crisp reflection of yourself when looking at the toaster. And I think what he's up to here is he's realizing the way in which products affirm us when we buy them. You know, you get a sense of, well, if there's some sort of a narcissistic act in shopping, he gets into that by showing that you're reflected in the thing that you want to consume. And so it gives you a sense of yourself.
And now we're nearing the end of the show. We're in The Citizen, The Subject, The State, three large works in one room, Mark. These, again, stylistically is very different. We've moved forward, I guess, quite a bit in time. Which one are you going to tell us about here?
So the first of these three paintings is called The Citizen, and it shows one of the IRA prisoners in Longkesh, or the maze. And this is at a time when the prisoners were going on what either is called the No Wash or the Dirty Protest. Basically, the prisoners wanted to be recognized as political prisoners rather than as criminals, and so they decided not to wear prison clothes and instead to cover themselves in their prison blankets, and then to smear their excrement on the walls of their cells. And when Hamilton saw these images on his TV screen, he was really startled by them and felt a kind of an affinity to these figures as one artist to another. He thought the smearing of the shit on the walls was almost like wall painting, and it reminded him of the spirals in ancient Irish art. Now, for me, that's really interesting that was his point of connection with these prisoners. He didn't believe in their methods. He didn't believe in the bombing tactics of the IRA at this time, but he did feel that this was a sort of a martyr figure, and so he decided to paint one of these prisoners.
And just before we finish, Mark, it seems that we've walked through the show of clearly one of the great British artists, post-war British artists, but also seen so much of the history of art, both from both sides of the Atlantic and through history.
Yes, I mean, I think what for me is really important about Hamilton is his connection to art history, but that's art history of his time and before. There's another room which assembles the Polaroid portraits that were made of him by all his artist collaborators, or all his artist friends, not so much collaborators, but very much the artists of his time, Jasper Johns, Roy Lichtenstein, Andy Warhol, they all made photographs of him for his project of these Polaroids. But in the last rooms of this show, you also see how he connects up to an older history of art and how he begins to think about artists like Fra Angelico, the Italian Renaissance painter, or Titian, or the Dutch artist Sarendam. I think that older history of art became more important to him. He'd always been interested in questions of perspective, but in the later years of his life, there are works which really do deal explicitly with the language of Renaissance painting.
There in the night was a wonderful scene. I'm
That was Mark Godfrey talking me through the wonderful Richard Hamilton retrospective at the Tate Modern in London. And the show, full of rich, brilliant allusions to the future of everything, is on until the 26th of May. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. And if you enjoyed that, there's more art to come, this time in Marrakesh.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau. The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House. And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
Welcome back to Culture on Monocle 24. Five editions, 10 years. In that time, the Marrakesh Biennale has grown from a small arts festival to a full-fledged event on the art world calendar. Until the end of the month, the city is showcasing a huge art exhibition on view in venues throughout the city. There's also a literary, performance and cinema and video programme. But 10 years in, how does an art biennale fit into a country whose politics and economics remain complex? To attempt an answer to this, the event decided to ask the question, where are we now, as a starting point and a theme. Monocle correspondent Kimberly Bradley dragged herself all the way to Marrakesh, tough gig, to check out the pulse of the multi-layered event.
In Marrakesh, the main square, Jamal Efna, is always a heady blast of trade, sound and colour. The fragrance of spices permeates the air. Snake charmers tease cobras. Men in fezes spin their tassels. Crowds of people eat, celebrate, sell, and yell. But until March 31st, Jamal Efna is also an important site for the 5th Marrakesh Biennale, an event that marries contemporary art to the city's traditions.
There are many reasons to begin an international arts festival in Morocco, but the main one being that this country and this city are an inspiration. We have so many people to thank for making this Biennale.
Vanessa Branson launched the Marrakesh Biennale 10 years ago as a small, multidisciplinary event inspired by a city she first fell in love with in the 1980s. It's since grown to attract 55,000 visitors per edition. For the first time ever, the Biennale secured the venues it wanted, not to mention the King's blessing and sizable sponsor support. Artistic director Ali Essebti runs down the project's scope.
We have 80% of the pieces that are commissioned. We have 47 participating artists for the main exhibition. We have, for the main program, which gathers the visual art exhibition, the literature, cinema and video and performing art, around 70 participants. Altogether with the parallel and partner project, we have around 50 exhibitions, which means 450 participants. And the venues, we have for the main program 8 venues.
A curator for each discipline was chosen from a pool of international applicants. In the end, all of them were Moroccan, even if several no longer live there. The global mix of aesthetics and approaches is obvious.
1/3 who are Moroccan artists. Then we have artists from Algeria, from Mexico, from India, from Berlin. And we really wanted to create this dialogue between local, regional and international. That's why we have a lot of events that are in English, other in French, other in the Moroccan dialect, Darija, and other in Arabic. So it's for everyone.
Indeed it is. The main exhibition plugs into the city itself. Old city sites include the square, a former bank directly on the square, the 16th century El Badi Palace, and the Moroccan craft museum Darcy Said. In the new city are the unfinished Theatre Royal and an abandoned Art Deco building called La Blasa, whose rooms are now filled with art projects. There's a new and wonderfully site-sensitive focus on performance and sound art. Turkish artist Shevdet Erik echoes the clicking of the storks roosting at El Badi Palace with a sound art piece. In 10 local taxis, sound art plays for customers, whether they're Biennale visitors or not. The unfinished Opera House Theatre Royal is filled with an eerie sound piece by the Northern European collective Freakout. In the Museum Darcy Said, Lebanese artist Munira Al-Soul creates a game of translating Arabic dialects as well as Dutch and English. Beyond this, there are excellent video works by Tala Madani, Katerina Gellar, Shazad Dawood, Karen Sitter, and Moroccan artist Hamza Haloubi. There's sculpture by Lebanese star Walid Raad, German artist Katinka Bock, or Belgian artist Eric van Hoof. It all points to curator Hisham Khalidi's concept of highlighting identity and creating what he calls fictional spaces. Even the venues reflect this liminal sense.
The Théâtre Royal is an opera house that was built in 1984 and after that never used, but it's still seen as an opera house. So there's a fictional space. There's also an abandoned space, which you see a lot here, that is supposedly used as a space that could be occupied, but is not. So that's a narrative. That gives you already a few ingredients to work with. Things as Darcy Said, when you get into this in-between space between what is it? Is it a museum or not? Is it a place where you conserve or where you keep artifacts or not? Is it Moroccan or is it French? There's an in-between space, which is fictional, pure fictional. And also that national identity, it's not a static process. It's a dynamic process, which is very difficult to trace. You cannot trace the root of it, but also not the location. There comes the where are we now.
Any highlights?
I would definitely go to the Jamaa Fnansi, the Bienvenue à Marrakech. I love in the evening. I love how that radiates in the Jamaa Fnansi when it's on. It's a neon work. The engine of Eric van Hoof is definitely a central piece to the whole exhibition, which is the piece is about Eric van Hoof has spent some time here, more than 8 months, in order to disassemble a V12 engine of Mercedes. And he gave all the parts to several artisans in the country and had it remade in their techniques and materials, and then reassembled it. If you look at that fictional space that the engine also occupies, is it an artwork or is it a piece of artisanat? Is it a piece of craftsmanship or is it engineering? You don't know what you're looking at. And that ambiguity is, for me, very, very important.
The ambiguity incites dialogue and intercultural frictions without being contrived. The Pakistan-born, London-based video artist Shehzad Dawood, who is showing a film at the El Badi Palace, offers his take on Khalidi's approach.
I think what Hisham's done very effectively is the way he hasn't tried to grandstand, you know, like you see in some biennales, that almost sit really awkwardly in context, this idea of integrating the works in a kind of very understated way. Not only, I think, works very well in the context and the choice of sites, etc., but I think it also fits very well in terms of a kind of Moroccan sensibility.
The event has clearly grown into something that's less about its founder and more about where it is. Vanessa Branson discusses the Biennale's evolution.
You know, I was thinking earlier on that we've earned our spurs, but it's right that it's taken a few years to get this acceptance. It means that we've really tried hard to really be very sensitive and diplomatic at every stage because, you know, I'm not Moroccan, and just to come in and impose my ideas on a country wouldn't be right. But now it's definitely being supported by the people from the country. Our biggest audience is going to be the people from Marrakesh and Casablanca and from the country. In fact, people are coming in from all over the country. And their reference points, they're much more performative. And so to actually respond to the things that the people here are really engaged in already and let them, you know, distort that and push out ideas, it's wonderful to see out on the main square these contemporary performances and the crowds that they're amassing. It's great.
Crowds indeed, as well as good times, and a lot of impressions to take home. For Monocle, in Marrakesh, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
Thank you, Kim, and that's just about all we have time for this week. Next time, we'll be exploring a bit of the Düsseldorf Quadriennale and going big on Moomins. You heard me. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilbao, but we all know it's Holly Fisher who does the hard graft. Time for one final song this week from her new album, Undress, which is out today. Here is Jessica Hoop with Whispering Light featuring Willie Mason. Thanks for tuning in.
Distance, mark of distance, your burden is your brilliance, and there's a vessel, a hidden vessel in the stone.
friend, and you'll wrestle, and how you'll wrestle to come.